This is Beverly Tomasi, and I'd like to welcome you to Microvascular Complications of Diabetes. We'll be talking about the prevention and treatment of eye, kidney, and nerve disease. This course is part of our Level 2 series, and we're updating it to provide the latest information and incorporate the standards of care for diabetes. And of course, this information is very important to our patients, because this topic is one I rather avoid when I teach my diabetes classes. I often say, you know, I really don't like going over this information, but I do tell the patients it's so important for you to know what the potential complications are, so you're motivated to take action and really help prevent these complications from occurring. And so I feel that, and the patients also agree with me, that knowledge is power. The more they know about these potential complications, and they know, the more they know about preventing them, the more empowered they feel about it. So I really like to bring this up with them and talk about it. We're going to be talking about the microvascular complications. So this does not include heart disease or big vessel disease. That's looking at eye, kidney, nerve damage, and also a little bit about circulation issues. And so what are the microvascular complications and goals of care? Here are three objectives. And the reason I put this image is because it really does take a team to help the person living with diabetes prevent complications. And if they do have complications, it really does take a team to help mitigate them and stop them from getting worse. So we're going to see patients in all different stages of complications. First of all, we're going to see patients with prediabetes that have no complications, hopefully. And then as they march on toward diabetes, and then diabetes for many years, especially if it's not controlled, the risk of complications might go up. So we're going to see patients where we can intervene and provide preventive measures and education and really cheerlead them to prevent these complications from happening. And then we're going to see patients who do have complications, who already have them from long-standing diabetes that perhaps was not well controlled. And so we're going to work with them to help limit the complications and prevent them from getting worse. We're also going to talk a lot about screening guidelines. Now, if anybody has taken this CDE exam or is planning on taking it, or the BCADM, you will know that screening guidelines come up a lot in these exams. And why do they appear? Well, because that's one of the most important things that patients can do, is to know when to get screened for complications and what to do with that information. And so these screening guidelines are very, very important. Before I go on, I'd like to launch a question and a poll here, and it's going to ask you, does diabetes cause complications? Just because you have diabetes, does it cause complications? Thanks for voting, everybody. It really helps me. So the answers are, yeah, diabetes causes complications. That was A. And B is, not always. Uncontrolled diabetes causes complications. So which answer do you think is right? It's interesting because I can see you guys choosing and then changing your answers. It's a complicated question. Okay, I'm going to close this and share your response. So 38% of you said, yeah, diabetes does cause complications. And 62 said, not always. Uncontrolled diabetes causes complications. And I would actually have to agree with B, the majority of what you chose, is that just because you have diabetes doesn't mean you're going to get complications. Uncontrolled diabetes leads to complications. But people who control their diabetes and control their blood pressure, cholesterol, and take good care of themselves can avoid complications. So here's the thing. Does diabetes cause complications? Uncontrolled diabetes causes complications. And that's a real powerful message of hope we want to give our patients. Because a healthy person with diabetes is a healthy person. So I think that's really important, because a lot of my patients say, well, I have diabetes, I'm going to get these complications, so I might as well let my blood sugars go up. No, that is not true at all. You can make a big difference in your life by managing your diabetes and living your healthiest lifestyle possible. Super important message of hope. So let's keep going and talk about the mechanisms of tissue injury by hyperglycemia. So why do people with diabetes who run chronically high blood sugars run into trouble? What's wrong with chronic hyperglycemia? Well, what happens is when there's too much glucose in the blood, it has to be absorbed somehow. So it can go into two different pathways. Let's just talk about the glycation pathway first. Now, the word glycation is just a fancy word for sugar coating. And when there's too much sugar in your blood, it glycates or sugar coats proteins like your red blood cells and your fat cells and your and the other molecules floating around in the bloodstream. The proteins and the fats get sugar coated, and this changes the functionality of those cells. And also the endothelial lining gets sugar coated, which leads to inflammation. But when the proteins and the fats get sugar coated, it alters the function and the turnover, and actually these are called advanced glycated end products, and AGE stands for advanced glycated end products. And these are sugar-coated elements of the blood that change functionality and actually lead to more inflammation. And they live longer. They just stay and they start clumping and they bind to receptors and cause all kinds of inflammation. So too much sugar in your blood glycates proteins and leads to this advanced glycated end product, which really causes inflammation. The other thing that happens is when there's too much glucose, it enters the sorbitol pathway to be broken down. When it enters the sorbitol pathway, sorbitol and fructose are toxic to our bodies, and they can cause oxidative stress and have all kinds of other effects. So these are some of the pathways that we're looking at to figure out why is hyperglycemia so damaging. So I have another quick question for you. Which of the following are modifiable risk factors for microvascular disease? And I'm going to go ahead and share this poll with you. So there's, we talk about modifiable and non-modifiable risk factors. So we want to find out, what can a patient modify to help decrease the risk? Is it A, blood pressure, glucose levels, smoking? Is it B, your age, type A personality, blood pressure? Is it C, your ethnicity, blood pressure, and diet? Or is it D, blood glucose, genetics, and activity level? Okay, most of you have voted, and I can tell by your response that this question is way too easy. Don't worry, next time I'll make it more difficult. I'm going to close this poll and share it with you. So I think that's pretty obvious that what can people change, and this is another important message of hope we want to give our patients, is that you can change these things. You can improve your outcomes. It's within your power. That's a very important message. Diabetes does not equal complications. There's things we can do to prevent those complications. And the two most important ones I have listed here are blood pressure and glucose levels. Those two, when elevated over a period of time, combined with genetics, can really increase the risk of eye, kidney, and nerve disease. And certainly smoking, a big risk factor. And thank goodness we've seen rates of smoking decline, but there's still people out there with diabetes smoking. And I have them come into my office, and if a patient smells like smoke when they come into my office, we are going to have a conversation about quitting smoking. So don't ever, worry about you're going to bug them or you're nagging them, because studies show that the more we talk about quitting smoking and the more resources we provide people, the more likely they are to succeed at quitting smoking. So these other answers are not right because they're not all modifiable. Can you modify a type A personality? I'm not sure. type A's get a lot done. I'm speaking from personal experience on that one. So the one A is the answer that we can modify all of those. Message of hope is really important for our patients. So now I'd really like to focus on eye disease education. And it is true that people with diabetes are at risk for eye disease from a variety of factors we're going to talk about. So we're going to talk about diabetes retinopathy, other complications, focus on prevention and treatment, and promoting self-care. But let's take a look at this beautiful structure known as our eye. We are so dependent on our vision. And if patients are trying to, be independent and have limitations in their vision, it's really difficult. So let's just take a look at the structures. We have the cornea, which is a protective layer of the eye. We have the iris that helps to allow light in or shut light out, so it's going to accommodate for light. We have the lens here. Now the lens is really important because it bends to help us focus. So it's going to flatten out when we're looking at further objects, and it's going to bend when we're trying to look up close. And that's why when we get older, it's harder to read because this lens stops bending. So that lens flexibility is really important. The other thing we want to look at is the retina. Now, what is the retina? We've heard of that. Well, it's the nerve layer in the back of our eye. So the nerve layer is very important because we would consider it the film in our camera. If we can look at the eye at the camera box, so the image comes in through our our eye, through our iris, the image is allowed in, and it goes to the back layer where the retina captures the image, and then it sends it through the optic nerve to the brain for interpretation. So this retinal layer is like the film capturing the image, and it needs blood and oxygen and glucose, of course. So here's the blood vessels that feed the retina, and we want those blood vessels to be healthy. If they become hypoxic, if the circulation isn't good, we run into that thing called retinopathy, which we'll look at in a minute. Another important part of the eye here is the macula. The macula is a little dent in the eye. It's a yellowish color in the back of the eye, and in the center of the macula is the fovea, and the fovea has the largest amount of cones in the eye, and this part of your eye is responsible for central vision, fine-tuning, fine vision. So if you ever hear the word macular edema, macular degeneration, it's things happening by the macula. We don't want damage near the macula because it can really affect our central vision. So we're always trying to protect the macula. We're trying to, of course, protect the entire eye, but central vision is so critical for independent living. Here's a fundus geography. So here's the back of our eye, and this is called a fundoscopy. And on the exam, I know sometimes you'll see this word, fundoscopy. What do patients need to make sure their eye function is healthy? And they need a dilated eye exam and also to look at the fundus to see how it's doing. So again, this is just looking at the blood vessels that are feeding the retina. Here's the optic disc where the optic nerve goes back to lead to the brain to interpret the information. Here's our macula responsible for central vision, and this very center, the fovea, where there's the most cones in the eye to help us, you know, with a fine vision. Here's the arteries that feed the retina, and then here's the veins. So look how healthy these blood vessels look. They're very healthy. They're not, they don't look like little sausages. There's no leakage. We'll take a look at an eye where the geography does not look that good. So now that we're kind of oriented to the eye, let's just take a look at an overview. And this is for diabetes eye disease. Diabetes is the leading cause of adult blindness, and that's due to two factors, retinopathy and macular edema. People with diabetes have 25 times the risk of ocular complications, including cataracts. 20% of people with type 2 have retinopathy at diagnosis. So as you know, on average, it takes about 6 years to diagnose type 2 diabetes. And so during that, 6.5 years, they might already be experiencing some eye disease. And I think really important for us is only 60% of patients receive appropriate treatment. So when we interact with people with diabetes, we want to find out, are you getting your eye screenings done? Do you have any problems with vision? And if they're not, help them get the resources to make that happen. So here's risk factors for retinopathy. The longer you have diabetes, always your rate of complications goes up. But that does not mean that everybody who's had diabetes for a long time gets complications. It's really a complex relationship between how long you've had it, age at diagnosis, race, different ethnic minorities have higher rates of complications, and your genes, what you bring with you. We all have protective genes, and we all have genes that promote disease. So it kind of depends where we are in that continuum. Now, here's the modifiable risk factors: your glucose control, blood pressure, smoking, your lipid levels, and then your kidney function and also renal disease. So we want to really prevent those from happening. Okay. How is everybody doing okay with the audio? If you're not, let me know. I'll try and do some problem solving, but hopefully if you are, we can make that better. Cataracts. So that's the first complication of diabetes associated with, well, cataracts are one of the big complications associated with diabetes, and I'll tell you why. Because when there's a lot of glucose in the blood, it can actually sugarcoat the lens of the eye. It's called, look at this word, glycosylation. So anytime you see glycated, glycosylation, it just means sugar coating. Things are getting glycosylated. And so here you can see is that lens of the eye that's supposed to bend and help us focus. And then if it becomes cloudy, light can no longer pour through the eye. And so everything is dim and poorly lit. And it's a gradual process, so many people don't even know it's happening. But we do have a very excellent treatment for that, and it's surgery. So I'm sure you work with a lot of patients who have had their lens replaced, and they are so, thrilled about it. My mom recently had cataract surgery, and she's like, I didn't realize there was so much light in the world. And so she was so thrilled about it. And so cataract is a common association with diabetes, and a lot of patients don't know that. But really encouraging them before they go to cataract surgery to get those lenses replaced, it's a good moment to get their blood sugars under control and a good motivator to keep their blood sugars in control after surgery too. Let's talk about macular edema. So we mentioned that the macula is responsible for central vision. So people with diabetes don't get macular degeneration. That's not their problem. They get macular edema. So this is a complication associated with diabetes. And the risk really goes up higher the longer you've had diabetes. So 15 years and greater, the risk is higher. And as I've mentioned, the macula is responsible for central vision. So what's happening is there's retinal thickening within 3 millimeters from the macula. So that little layer of nerve tissue is becoming thickened, and that can really impact and impair vision. How do we treat this? Well, focal laser treatment, but now some new treatments are including these medications, which I'll go over in a minute, which protect and can reverse macular edema to a certain degree. So here's a picture of macular edema, and this is just a side view of the retina. So here's a normal retina. You can see the top layer here has some dents in it. It's not inflamed compared to this picture on the right. This is a retina with diabetes macular edema, and there's swelling here. And this swelling is shown in this picture, this white area. And this is caused by leaking microaneurysms and exudates. And it is a most common cause of visual loss among people with type 2 diabetes. Here's the optic nerve, or the optic cup where the optic nerve travels, and here's the blood vessels. But certainly macular edema, a big problem for people with diabetes. But there is a new approved treatment for macular edema, very exciting. And it just got approved for macular edema with retinopathy, and it's called antivascular endothelial growth factor, VEGF. And I went to a presentation about this about 6 years ago, and it was so exciting because the researcher who was talking about it was saying that patients actually gain a line on the eye chart, and gaining a line, which means improving your vision so you can see a line better than you could before this treatment started, really improves people's outcomes on life and their ability to take care of themselves. So they were using, these are the different medications that are being used currently and approved, and they're a once a month injection. So a lot of patients do complain about them. They say they're very uncomfortable, but they're happy with the outcomes. Let's ask another question. Which of the following describes proliferative retinopathy? Is it A, cotton wool spots and hemorrhages? I'm going to go ahead and launch my poll. Is it B, increased lens opacity? Is it C, stiffening of the lens? Or is it D, new blood vessel growth? Oh, Anna Marie wants to know if the eye injections are expensive. Yes, they are expensive. I mean, if you're cash pay, they're going to be expensive. Hopefully you have good insurance and it's covered. And so all of these newer medications, just assume any new medication. I'm just looking at your answers real quick. Any new medication is always expensive, and without insurance, cost prohibitive for most people, I would imagine. Okay, so 52% of you have voted. So I'm going to add a word into my question. Which of the following best describes proliferative retinopathy? What is the unique feature that we know this person has proliferative retinopathy? Is a better way of saying this. All right. 56%. Okay, most of you have voted. So I'm going to go ahead and close this poll. You know what? Let me just share this with you. Because proliferative retinopathy is D. The right answer is D. There's new blood vessels growing. That is the right answer. But as you work up to diabetes proliferative retinopathy, we might see some cotton wool spots and hemorrhages. We're seeing that the eye is getting more diseased. And people might have, in addition to proliferative retinopathy, lens opacity, the lens might be more opaque, and stiffening. But the truth is, with diabetic proliferative retinopathy, the main feature is new blood vessel growth, and I'm going to go over that with you right now. So when you talk about diabetes proliferative retinopathy, it means new blood vessels are growing because a retina isn't getting enough oxygen. So it's hypoxic, and the retina is screaming out, I need more oxygen. So the eye creates more blood vessels to feed the retina, and those new blood vessels are damaged, and they cause a lot of problems for people. So the retina is a layer of, the retina, layer of nerve tissue in the back of the eye responsible for processing images and light. Very important. That's the film in our camera. Damage to the microvascular layer that nourishes the retina is what we consider retinopathy. So that microvascular layer is becoming damaged. There's leakage of blood components and new unstable blood vessels secondary to hypoxia. And if the nerve layer is damaged, it can lead to symptoms and vision. So here's the natural history. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this, but there's mild non-proliferative diabetic retinopathy. So this means non-proliferative, no new blood vessels are being created. But you're going to start seeing microaneurysms. So we re-examine those people annually. But once we get to moderate non-proliferative diabetic retinopathy, we're going to see some other abnormalities. We're going to check their eyes more frequently. And then we get to this place of severe non-proliferative. So the eye is becoming more and more unhealthy, and we could tell because there's interretinal hemorrhages. There's venous beading. I'll show you what that means. It looks the blood vessels look like little sausages, and there's abnormalities. There's no signs yet of proliferative disease. There's no new blood vessels, but we're going to keep an eye on those patients several times a year. And so here's non-proliferative. So this is not a good situation either. You can see we're having some cotton wool spots, some hemorrhaging, edema, exudates, all kinds of bad stuff happening in the eye. But there's no new blood vessels yet. But when we look at this eye, or when the ophthalmologist or optometrist looks at this eye, they know this eye is heading toward proliferative retinopathy. So here's non-proliferative. There's aneurysms, hemorrhages, hard exudates. And then here is proliferative. Look at all these new little blood vessels growing. You see them? And these little blood vessels are very weak. They break, they leak, they cause all kinds of problems. We need to stop this immediately. And how do we stop this? Well, it's laser photocoagulation. They're going to blast these little vessels with a laser beam to stop them from growing, because they can really lead to damage. So here's proliferative retinopathy. See, there's hemorrhaging. Look at these new blood vessels growing. They look like little cauliflower. I don't know what you would exactly describe them as, but they look, I don't know, they don't look healthy, let's put it that way. They're small, they're squiggly, and actually they can act as a scaffolding in the back of the eye and cause retinal detachment. So when we see this, we know that there's hypoxia going on, this eye is not healthy. I just want to talk about some signs of PDR. So PDR, kind of proliferative diabetic retinopathy, that's what PDR is. You can see if we have central vision but we lose peripheral vision, this is how we see the giraffes. But look what happens if we lose central vision, if the macula is affected. Then we lose that center of our vision and we can see the peripheral. And people do better when we preserve the central vision. They can function better. Either one is very damaging. Here's views of boys by a person with normal vision. Here's retinopathy. Remember those pictures we saw, the hemorrhaging and the exudates? They're going to block people from having a normal vision. And so this can really affect a person's, their quality of life really goes down when their vision is impacted. So we're still on proliferative diabetic retinopathy. Clinical findings, ischemia-induced neovascularization. So we can have it near the optic disc or elsewhere in the retina. It can also lead to tears and detachment. And if they have retinopathy, we must also look to see if they have macular edema. If a person does have proliferative diabetic retinopathy, we're going to be very aggressive. We're going to follow them. We're going to do fundus photography. So we're going to inject dye into their eye and look and see how their eye is doing, how it's progressing. We're going to do that panretinal photocoagulation with a laser beam. And if there is bleeding into the vitreous, we're going to actually have to take out their vitreous, do a vitrectomy, and replace it with an artificial vitreous. And if macular edema is present, we're going to have to evaluate that and inject medications. So here's a fluorescein angiogram 5 minutes after dye injection. I think it's kind of interesting. The fuzzy white areas represent dye leaking into the retina for microaneurysms. And this illustrates the mechanism which can actually lead to macular edema. So those blood vessels leaking, leading to that edema. Now, here's a picture of a patient with retinopathy, and they did the panretinal photocoagulation where all these little laser beams stopped the new blood vessels from growth. And really, about 15 years ago, I think they really found out how effective this was and that it decreases risk of severe vision loss by 50% and destroys 12% of the retina and loss of visual field. So this is interesting because the peripheral vision is lost, 12%, but it preserves central vision. And once stabilized, can achieve excellent control of proliferative diabetic retinopathy. It won't get worse if we keep controlling blood glucose and blood pressure. So another important message to our patients, just because you got that photocoagulation doesn't mean you can let your blood sugars, run high now. We still have to really work on getting those to target your blood pressure and your blood sugars. Really, really important. A lot of patients I've worked with have complications and they think, well, I've got complications anyway, why control my blood glucose? It is so important because if your blood sugars continue to run high, your complications will get worse and you're going to get other complications. But if you can keep your blood glucose close to target, you're going to mitigate other problems from happening. And so retinopathy prevention. To reduce the risk or slow progression of retinopathy, here we go. We're going to see this over and over again during this lecture. Optimize glycemic control and optimize blood glucose. I didn't mean to say that. Blood pressure control. So look at these little boys. Now you can see them fully, their brightness and their light. Quick question three. Which of the following is correct regarding eye screening for people with diabetes? I'm going to go ahead and launch this poll. A, all people with diabetes must get a complete eye exam every year. A, B, all people diagnosed with type 1 should receive an immediate eye exam. C, all people diagnosed with type 2 should receive an immediate eye exam. Or D, people with diabetes over age 60 should receive an eye exam every 6 months. So what is the best answer here? And really read through these because these are the type of questions, if you haven't taken your CDE exam yet, that you might see on the exam. And it's important to read through all, get rid of the wrong answers and choose the best answer. And I'll just leave it at that. I'm going to be taking my exam again next year, so I'm kind of excited. It will be my sixth time taking the exam. All right, I'm going to go ahead and close this poll and share with you. Okay, so the first answer was what I call a juicy answer. I was kind of luring you in with this answer, but I want to say something. In an answer, whenever you see the word all and must, all people with diabetes must get a complete eye exam every year. Be skeptical. Read it twice. Because in general, when you see all and must, it's not the right answer. There's usually some room for flexibility. And actually, the American Diabetes Association does say that if your eyes are normal and you have diabetes, you can get an exam every 2 to 3 years. So actually, A is not the right answer. And I'm going to just so you can see 61% of you chose that. So if you chose that, it just helps inform you that, hey, this was not exactly the right answer. And just to go through the standards of care for complications and risk management of complications. Okay, B, all people diagnosed with type 1 should receive an immediate eye exam. Nobody chose that. C, so B is wrong. C, all people diagnosed with type 2 diabetes should receive an immediate eye exam. And even though this has the word all, it is the correct answer. C is right. Because people with type 2 diabetes have had it for up to 6 years, so they might already have some complications. So all type 2s should receive an immediate eye exam. Let's keep going. So retinopathy screening. Screen with initial dilated and comprehensive eye exam by an ophthalmologist or an optometrist. So anybody diagnosed with diabetes, type 2 at diagnosis, then every 1 to 2 years, so it's not every year, and then type 1 within 5 years of diagnosis, then every 1 to 2 years. So you can see there's a little flexibility here. We don't have to do it every year. It can be as long as every 2 years. We can use a high-quality fundus photograph as a screening tool. But the initial exam should be done in person, so we want to get a good baseline. But if the patient wants to get a review of their eyes, we can use these fundus photographs and send them off to an ophthalmologist or optometrist trained to read and interpret those. Those can be done as screenings to see how the eyes are doing. But the initial eye exam should be done in person. And we need to make sure we refer patients with macular edema and severe non-proliferative disease to a trained specialist. So patients who are moving toward, PDR or have macular edema really need to see a specialist in the field. So this is just a new part of the standards that was incorporated a few years ago, that high-quality fundus photography can be used to screen for retinopathy. And we need to make sure that the interpretation of the image is performed by a trained eye care provider. And it can serve as a screening tool, but it's not a substitute for a comprehensive eye exam. So initially we perform comprehensive eye exam and initially at intervals thereafter, and it doesn't specify how often. As far as women during pregnancy, women with pre-existing diabetes who are planning pregnancy or who are pregnant should have their eyes evaluated and in the first trimester and then close follow-up throughout pregnancy and for 1 year postpartum, just to evaluate how their eyes are responding to pregnancy. So ongoing retinopathy screening after the initial exam, then we do an annual exam, but it can be less frequent every 2 to 3 years if one or more eye exam is normal. More frequent eye exams if retinopathy is progressing. And the other thing I really like to think about is if my patients have limited vision, how can we help them maintain the most independent life possible? This is really important for them. Do they have the skills and self-care skills and ability to perform injection of insulin, blood glucose monitoring? Can they read instructions? Can they cook at home without being in danger of burning themselves? What about shopping and transportation? And so we want to ask our patients with low vision about this. How are you doing at home? How are you managing? And I really want to refer you to a resource that's terrific. It's the American Federation for the Blind, 1-800-AF-BLIND. They're all over the country, and they have free resources for people who have limited or low vision. Like you can get a talking blood pressure cuff from them, a talking glucose meter. They'll come to the home and do a safety assessment. They're a wonderful, wonderful resource for people living with low vision, especially for our patients with diabetes who are really struggling with this. And then the psychosocial issues around limited vision, because it can be very isolating. And so we want to see if we want to get, you know, social worker. Thank you, Joan. For letting me know about my slides being stuck, so I appreciate that. So let's see, where do my, I'll go back with my slides and we'll just go over this a little bit. So retinopathy screening, I was talking about screening with initial dilated and comprehensive eye exam, type 2 at diagnosis in every 1 to 2 years, type 1 within 5 years, and then every 1 to 2. Later on, I say up to 3 years, so up to 3 is still acceptable. We can use fundus photography as a screening tool, but initial exam should be done in person. And then here's the high-quality fundus photography to screen for retinopathy. Here's what the machine would look like. And then this image is sent to an off-site ophthalmologist or optometrist to interpret the image. And then here's the pregnancy. So women during pregnancy should be evaluated for retinopathy at baseline and then on an ongoing basis. You're welcome. Thanks, you guys, for coaching me along. All right. And there's a 1-800 blind phone number. And then Prodigy Voice Meter. So this is a really excellent talking meter. It received an A+ from the award. It received an A+ Access Award from the American Federation for the Blind. So the American Federation for the Blind rates, you know, devices for people with low vision and says how easy are they to use. And this meter is really wonderful. It has different languages. It's easy to use. It's not that expensive. Cost is $84. It's come down a little bit. And then you see 50 strips are very standard in their cost, about $35. And insurance should cover this for people with limited vision. Okay, so that wraps up our eye disease. So we want to really, let me just go back one slide, evaluate our patients to make sure they're getting the appropriate initial exam and screening evaluations for eye disease, and if they do have eye disease, that they're getting appropriate care and that they're really working hard to keep their blood glucose and their blood pressure to target. Really, really important. You know, don't lose hope. You want to preserve your eye, your vision that you do have. Let's keep working on getting your blood sugar and blood glucose to target. And if they're really struggling with depression and, you know, they just are struggling with their diabetes, reaching out to other resources like a support group or a social worker or, you know, a therapist to help them address those issues. Let's talk about kidney disease now. Kidney disease is a big deal, and we're going to talk about the epidemiology of the kidney disease. What do the kidneys do? What are the stages and progression and diagnostic tests? Let's take a look at this poll question. John's dad had diabetes and kidney failure. John wants to learn the risk factors for kidney disease. Which of the following describes those actions that increase your risk for kidney disease? Is it, I'm going to launch my poll and I'll remember to close it this time. Oh, Elaine wants to know, I'm just looking at questions. How do they see the strip? Oh, get the strip to the test if they're blind. They can do it. It's so amazing because a machine tells them when the blood is sucked up into the strip. So the machine will say, I can't remember what it says. Thank you. Counting down or something. So the machine talks to them so they know if they've got the blood or not. Okay, anyways, A. What describes risk factors or increased risk for kidney disease? A. Alcohol, excessive alcohol intake and daily Tylenol. B. Family history of kidney disease or smoking. C. High protein diet and excessive trans fat intake. Or D. Diet high in processed foods and sodium. So I want to know which of the following is at most likely, highest risk. Which grouping of the following creates the highest risk for kidney disease? All right, thanks for voting, everybody. I see you're switching your answers a little bit, but not too bad. So which of the following groupings confer or let us know this patient's at very high risk for kidney disease. Okay, I'm going to go ahead and close this. Share your answers. So, according to the American Kidney Association, I think that's their correct name. Somebody out there probably knows their correct name, but I looked up what are the risk factors for kidney disease, for people, and the highest risk factors actually are B, family history of kidney disease and smoking combined with diabetes. So if they have diabetes, family history of kidney disease, and they smoke, that is very high risk, the highest of all of these. So if you have a diet high in processed foods and sodium, which 27% of you chose, that doesn't increase your risk for kidney disease unless you have a family history and you have diabetes, those two together. You see what I'm saying? So these two, family history and smoking, really do have the highest risk for a person living with diabetes of having kidney disease. So B is a correct answer, and 70% of you chose that. Great job, you guys. High protein intake, I just want to talk about that for a minute, because for many years we've been talking about eating less protein to protect your kidneys, and the new guidelines clearly say that even for a person with diabetes, kidney disease, there's no good evidence to support limiting protein intake, and that's from the new ADA standards. I'll go over that in a minute. So let's just take a look at our beautiful kidneys. I do love my pancreas, but I also really love my kidneys. I don't know. I actually love all my organs. They're pretty critical. But the kidney is the size and shape of an Idaho potato. It's retroperitoneal. What does that mean? Well, it sits more toward the back, toward our back. It filters the entire blood volume of our body every 30 minutes. That's pretty shocking. 48 times a day, it filters all the blood in our body and gets rid of, you know, the toxins. It excretes water, urea, and waste. It maintains our blood volume. It helps balance electrolytes and acid base. It regulates our blood pressure. It synthesizes erythropoietin. So people with kidney disease are often anemic. And it helps maintain our calcium phosphorus levels and activates vitamin D and helps absorb calcium. Wow. So the kidneys do a lot for us, and keeping them in good shape is really important. We can live with one kidney, and actually, even, you know, our kidneys can perform well when they're 60% destroyed, 70% destroyed. Right around 80% destruction is when they really can't do their jobs. That's true for a lot of our organs. Once it gets down to 20% functionality left, it just can't do what it needs to do to maintain its functionality. Don Dicker has helped me out. It's called the National Kidney Foundation. Thank you very much, Don. That's the correct name, National Kidney Foundation. That's a great website to Google, by the way. A lot of good information. So the risk factors of kidney disease. What are the two leading risk factors with a person with diabetes? Hypertension and hyperglycemia. What was the two leading risk factors for eye disease? Hypertension, hyperglycemia. It's so important. Looking at blood pressure management is critical for our patients, and looking at blood glucose management. So we want to give them the message of hope. We know that getting your blood sugar and blood pressure down will protect your eyes and your kidneys. Let's see if it's going to protect our nerves too. Other risk factors: kidney stones, obesity, smoking, heart disease, family history of kidney disease, and over the age of 60. Here's a troubling thing. Kidney disease often has no symptoms, and many times it's detected too late. And I see that all the time where I teach diabetes classes. My patients, you know, their GFR is just tumbling down and nobody's paying attention. And so I really empower my patients to talk to their providers and say, hey, my GFR is too low. What can we do to protect my kidneys? And by giving the patients that permission to verbalize to their provider is very empowering for them. And believe me, if a provider hears a patient say my GFR is lower than I like it to be, they're going to listen because they know that patient is engaged. So as educators, we're always trying to give our patients the language to help express their needs. And so I teach them, what does GFR mean? We'll talk about that in a minute. And so that they can share that with their doctors and providers. Diabetic nephropathy, kidney disease, nephropathy. Most new cases of chronic kidney disease are attributed to diabetes in America. If you look over here, here's people with kidney failure, 2005. Takes a while to catch up to the data. But 44% diabetes, 27% high blood pressure, and then there's some other reasons. But if you go to a dialysis unit, most people are there because of diabetes. And it's not type 1, it's type 2 diabetes. And as you know, people with diabetes often have high blood pressure. And if you went to this dialysis unit, there's going to be more minorities there because people with diabetes who are minorities experience more kidney failure. So we really want to reach out to people at risk and help them keep healthy. 220,000 people in the U.S. have kidney failure due to diabetes. You know what? I just want to bring up some relationships between diabetes and chronic kidney disease. Once you have kidney disease, you can die of kidney disease, but the leading cause of death is heart disease. And this is so interesting because I worked with a lot of patients on dialysis or patients with kidney transplants, and you know, I saw many of them die from a cardiovascular event, stroke or heart attack. We want to protect their big blood vessels too, and that's protecting blood pressure and cholesterol. Once a patient is spilling protein into their urine, so if a patient has any protein in their urine, we used to call it microalbuminuria, but now we call it protein in their urine, it means that they're increased risk of heart disease. Protein in your urine, if you're urinary albumin excretion rate is greater than 30, means you're at increased risk of heart disease. So we know there's a linkage there. So if you're working with patients with kidney disease, protect their heart. We want to do everything we can to help prevent cardiovascular disease. The other thing is 1/4 to 1/3 of all insulin is cleared by the kidneys. So this is true also for diabetes medications like sulfonylureas. These medications are cleared by the kidneys, so if the kidneys aren't working right, these medications hang out longer in the bloodstream and can lead to hypoglycemia. Very important to know. I'm always asking my colleagues, what's a creatinine? What's a creatinine if a patient's getting low blood sugar? Because I know if they have elevated creatinine and they're on insulin or sulfonylureas, they're much more likely to get hypo. What does this mean? Renal retinal syndrome. It means if you have kidney disease, you probably have eye disease. If you have eye disease, you have kidney disease. When there's microvascular disease in one part of the body, it's usually happening in another part simultaneously. But look at this. I have one piece of good news. 70 to 80% of people with diabetes don't get kidney disease. That's good news. And as I've been talking about, early and aggressive intervention is crucial, is critical. So let's just talk a little bit about what is kidney disease. What is nephropathy? Well, early on, as the blood sugars are high, hyperglycemia causes renal hyperfiltration and glomerular capillary hyperperfusion. So the kidneys and the glomeruli right here are being bombarded with sugar and a lot of fluid and many times high blood pressure. And this bombardment over time causes functional and structural damage to the glomeruli, the filtering units, and it increases permeability, and then the protein starts leaking through. As I was mentioning, the filtering unit no longer holds the protein, the patient starts urinating protein, and that tells us that they have kidney disease and they're at risk for heart disease. There's mesangial expansion, I'll show you a picture of that in a minute, and sclerosis. So the blood vessels just shut down and become hard and small, and the kidney becomes small too. And this is due to insufficient insulin. Oh, look at this word again, glycosylation. Everything's sugar-coated, and there's stress hormones being released, like growth hormone, glucagon, and vasoactive hormones. So here's a healthy kidney, proper size, low urine protein, and then here's kidney disease. It becomes much smaller. There's more granular surface. There's decreased function, high urine protein. And you can look at the glomeruli. Here you'll see that a healthy filtering unit looks like this. And then this is that mesangial expansion happening right here. And then sclerosis of the blood vessels. And then there's leakage of protein in the urine. So here's ischemic pyramids listed here. So this kidney is unhealthy kidney, and it all starts because of that hyperglycemia and hypertension. So look at this again. To keep kidneys healthy, optimize glucose control, optimize blood pressure control. And I have A listed here because A means this is based on excellent evidence. We have good scientific data to support this and tell our patients this is based on science and lots of great evidence. So when we screen for kidney disease, we're going to screen for several things. We're going to look at urine albumin creatinine ratio, and it's UACR, urine albumin creatinine ratio, and glomerular filtration rate, GFR. Those are two things we're going to take a look at. We're also going to look at the creatinine. Okay, so when do we do this? Type 2 at diagnosis, because they might have had diabetes for a while, then yearly, and type 1 with diabetes for 5 years, then yearly. And we're going to make sure we treat hypertension. This is so important. If they're spilling protein in their urine, we've got to treat that hypertension, get their blood pressure down to protect their kidneys. So this is new because we used to call protein in the urine, we used to call it normal microalbuminuria, macroalbuminuria. They ditched that in the 2015 ADA standards of care. What they said here is there's two categories, and this is urine albumin. You can just do a creatinine ratio, a spot collection is acceptable. Normal protein excretion is less than 30 milligrams per gram. Anything over 30 means there's increased urinary albumin excretion. It's not normal. Okay, so less than 30 is what we're looking for. Anything above 30 means the kidneys are spilling protein they shouldn't be. It means that person's at risk for heart disease. It means that we need to take action and control their blood pressure. To test for this, it's a little bit trickier because to test for creatinine ratio here, two of the three tests within 3 to 6 months have to be abnormal to confirm diagnosis. So if you just get it once and it's positive, you have to do it at least 2 to 3 times. And it can be interfered with the accuracy if they've exercised, have an infection, fever, CHF, hyperglycemia, and hypertension may falsely elevate urinary excretion. So we have to do it a few times and wait at least 3 to 6 months. And if it comes up positive, two of the three tests, then we know they are certainly spilling protein. And then this looks at how we characterize and stage chronic kidney disease. So this is looking at GFR. So before we're looking at albumin excretion in the urine, now we're looking at GFR. And normally, and this says kidney damage, so this is a person that we know already has some kidney problems. We want to see that GFR more than 90. So actually, anybody, when I look at my patients with diabetes, GFR greater than 90 means your kidneys are normal. Mildly decreased GFR is 60 to 89. Right then, we're going to say, let's do whatever we can to control blood sugar and blood pressure. And then we keep going down, moderately decreased, severely. When we're less than 30, that's really serious, and we need to take immediate action. And then kidney failure is less than 15. And in the standards of care, they have some really great charts. I just copied the charts there. But for all patients, the management of chronic kidney disease, that's the new word. We don't call it end-stage renal disease anymore. We call it chronic kidney disease. We want to measure their creatinine, urinary albumin excretion, and potassium. But if those numbers start going in the 45 to 60, we might consider referring to a nephrologist to see if there's any other non-diabetes kidney disease. So we're suspicious. Why at this level are they getting the severe kidney disease? Let's get a specialist to check it out. You can see here when it goes down to 30 to 44, we're going to monitor very closely, and less than 30 GFR, refer to a nephrologist. So take a look at your patient's GFR and see where they're at on that continuum. And let's just talk about treatment, kidney disease treatment, ACE or ARB. Okay, this is really a big change. Before, if you had type 1 diabetes, they would put a lot of our patients on an ACE or ARB, even the type 2s, to protect their kidneys as primary prevention. They, and the new standards of care, they say an ACE or ARB is not recommended for prevention of kidney disease if blood pressure is normal and urinary albumin excretion is less than 30. So that's really important to know. I've worked with a lot of patients with type 1 who are on an ACE and they had normal blood pressure. So they're saying that hasn't shown to improve outcomes. But if they have diabetes and they should be on an ACE or an ARB if they are above 30 and their urinary albumin excretion rate. So that's an important, you know, difference to note. If they have no protein in their urine, if it's normal, they don't need ACE or ARB as prevention. But if they have protein in their urine, we're going to start an ACE or an ARB. And that's ACE inhibitor, and these are two different types of blood pressure medications. And I do have a really nice handout on blood pressure medications on my articles library if you want to download those, and you can look at all the different ACEs and ARBs and calcium channel blockers and beta blockers and all that stuff. So that's under my articles, under articles by Bev and team. You'll see it there. But anyways, what they also say is monitor creatinine and potassium when they're on these medications. Blood pressure medications can alter electrolytes, and we want to keep an eye on that, and it can lead to orthostatic hypotension. Now we're talking about GFR. So if the GFR is less than 60, we want to evaluate and manage potential complications of chronic kidney disease, and certainly consider a referral to a specialist when it's difficult to get their blood pressure down and the kidney disease is advanced. And I wrote here, protein restriction not recommended anymore, no longer recommended. It didn't seem to improve outcomes. So what's the treatment for chronic kidney disease? Well, there's four primary treatment options. There's hemodialysis, where they can go to a center and get dialyzed, or they can do peritoneal dialysis many times from home. Patients are opting to do that. And even some hemodialysis now, I've heard about some home-based units. Kidney transplantation is really the best thing out there for patients, but look at this. 120,000 Americans are waiting for a kidney. Only 17,000 people receive a kidney, and every day 12 people die waiting for a kidney. And this is what I saw when I worked at Stanford Hospital, so many patients who are just waiting for that kidney transplant just did not receive it. So just talking to people in our general life about making sure they're organ donors is so important. And some of our patients actually might choose no treatment. They may choose to, to pass on because they don't want to, they just don't have it in them to manage their life with chronic kidney disease, and that's a choice too. And as you can imagine, you know, having chronic kidney disease can really affect us in many ways, psychologically, depression, stress, so making sure our patients have access to support groups, counseling, and coping skills to deal with this. It's a lifetime, and it's really difficult. Okay, so let's move on now to nerve disease, and this will be the last 30 minutes of our presentation. And we're going to talk about diabetes nerve disease, and I've included some really great handouts on your resource page. One is called Autonomic Neuropathy Clinical Features, and the other one is Neuropathy Medications for Diabetes. And I would encourage you to download those and print those out and just have them available, because I would say in my practice, and I work with a lot of patients with nerve disease, and they're not being successfully treated. They're living with chronic pain. And so on that sheet, I talk about medications for neuropathy, and I've used that sheet also when I talk to providers as a consultant and to my patients. So we're going to talk about the causes, the different types of neuropathy, detection, prevention, and treatment, and what's some key information we want to share with our patients about neuropathy. I just want to share a theory with you. Like, you patients always ask me, why do patients with diabetes get neuropathy, or why do people get this thing? And essentially, neuropathy is, you know, death of the nerve cell, boiled down to its most basic definition. The nerve cell die. Now, the thing about nerve cells is they don't need insulin to use glucose. And so the nerve cell just kind of assimilates, or through osmosis gets glucose in it. But if there's too much glucose surrounding the nerve cell has to get rid of it. And so what happens is the glucose enters the sorbitol pathway. When it enters the sorbitol pathway, glucose is reduced to sorbitol by aldose reductase. I don't know if you've heard about this. There was medications they were working on for neuropathy called aldose reductase inhibitors. They were trying to stop this pathway from happening. They haven't panned out, but there's still hope. Okay, and then it enters the polyol pathway, where sorbitol is oxidized to fructose by sorbitol dehydrogenase. And as you remember from that very first slide, glucose, sorbitol, and fructose are all toxic to the cells. They decrease the nerve velocity, they decrease oxygenation, and they increase oxidative stress. This is bad news for that nerve cells, for your nerve cells. So let's do a quick question. Mary has had diabetes for 10 years and wants to reduce her risk of neuropathy. What are the most important steps she can take to limit her risk? Is it A, to decrease coffee intake? I'm going to launch this poll. Is it B, to control blood glucose? Is it C, to take vitamin B12 daily? Or is it D, apply capsaicin cream? Hello? Okay. Apply capsaicin cream, sorry about that, and two extremities twice daily. Okay, can you all hear me? Are you there? Okay, sorry guys. We're back. Thank you. So which of the following will help, what are most important steps she can take, Mary can take, to limit her risk of neuropathy? Lose weight and decrease coffee intake, A. B, control blood glucose. C, take vitamin B12 daily. Or D, apply capsaicin cream to her extremities twice a day. All right, I'm going to go ahead and close this poll since most of you have voted. And I'm going to share it with you. So you guys are on fire. 100% of you said control blood glucose. And that's exactly right. 100% of you chose control blood glucose. And that is exactly what she needs to do. As a matter of fact, we'll see in a slide coming up that controlling blood glucose is the only known way currently to help prevent progression of neuropathy. So let's take a look. What is neuropathy? Well, diabetic neuropathy is a demonstrable nerve disorder and destruction, either clinical or subclinical, that occurs with diabetes without other causes. So this is an important message that I want to share with you, that a lot of my patients come in to see me and they say, well, I have diabetes neuropathy. And I look at their A1C, and their A1C has been 6.5, 6.3, 6.2. They've never had a high A1C. And sometimes I'll see that, or I'll see the neuropathy is on one side. So then I know the neuropathy might be due to other factors such as chemotherapy, back injury, exposure to some chemical in the past. There's a lot of other things that can cause nerve damage besides diabetes. And so that's really frustrating for patients, I have to be honest, because they want to know, why do I have this neuropathy? And so sometimes it's not known, but the main important thing we need to do is help them treat it to prevent, ongoing pain and decrease quality of life. And there's two, so Anna Marie was asking a question about, what about HIV patients? A lot of HIV patients do get neuropathy also from the medications. So there's other medications or chemotherapeutic agents out there that can get neuropathy. But to say you have neuropathy, you have to have two abnormalities present. You have to have symptoms or signs or an abnormal quantitative test. So we'll talk about some tests that we can use in a minute. But here's some risk factors for neuropathy. So older we are, hypertension, hyperglycemia, LDL, smoking, this is a repeat of what we've talked about before. Alcohol intake can really increase neuropathic pain. And I have here nutrition, and what I mean here is, if you should eat a lot of omega-3 fatty acids, because lack of them seems to increase your risk of neuropathy. I mean, the main central focus here is the blood sugars, but these are other modifiable risk factors that can help mitigate it or make it worse. And so we want to look at those other contributing risk factors and help them shut those ones, shut down what they can shut down, and help on our side with the blood sugar, blood pressure, and cholesterol control. But I want to ask you a quick question. What two office tests can be used to detect diabetes neuropathy? Is it pinprick and electrophysiology testing? Is it monofilament and tuning fork? Is it hot-cold discrimination testing? Or is it Babinski reflex assessment? Which one is right? What two office tests? These are tests that can be done in the office. No special, no fancy equipment required. So that means we could do it, that we could actually do it. And actually, in my diabetes class, for graduation, I actually do test people's nerves using two of these devices. I see how nervy they are. Okay, I'm going to go ahead and close this and share. So 76% of you chose monofilament and tuning fork. That is the right answer. This very simple device called a monofilament can be used to detect people's lots of nerves. And I'm going to add to my resource page a place where you can get monofilaments. I talk about this a lot in my lower extremity assessment class. I have an online course on lower extremity assessment, and also a tuning fork. So I'll put some resources for you on that. But these are the two gold standards. The other ones, A, C, and D, we do not use or are not recognized as standard practice. But B is, and 76% of you got that right. So good job. I'm just going to say, this is from the American Diabetes Association Standards of Care. As far as nerve disease screening, what do? Screen all patients for nerve disease using simple tests such as monofilament. And I didn't list it here, but tuning fork is also mentioned. Type 2 at diagnosis. So we really want to, you know, use that monofilament on the bottom of a person's foot with type 2 diabetes when they're diagnosed, and annually. Type 1 diabetes after 5 years, then annually. And then here's what I wanted to say about what really helps neuropathy. Tight glycemic control is the only strategy shown to prevent or delay the development and progression of neuropathy. So I don't know what to say. I mean, that could be a real motivator for some patients to say, you know, we really want to get your blood glucose down. I know this, you know, walking and being safe and having your nerves firing and alive is really important for you, or whatever wording you want to use. That was kind of awkward, but, you know, we all have our own way of saying things, but whatever we can do to tell patients how important glucose control is to preserve their nerves. And if the patient does have neuropathy, we really want to help with pain management. Yeah, so Anna Marie's saying, well, I thought ADA recommends checking the patient's feet at each office visit. They do. If that patient has any loss of protective sensation, we check at each office visit. But that's just screening, at least once a year, but we may do it more frequently if the patient is high risk. Now, I love this slide. Here's a picture of your skin, of your epidermal layer. Look at these are the little nerves that are going up to the surface. Is that a great picture? Okay, so these nerves are feeling what? Heat, cold, pain, temperature, pressure, you know, the way your foot lands in space. Those nerve endings gather the data, sends it back up your spinal column for your brain for interpretation. So it's really important that the nerves are healthy. Here's an epidermal layer. Look at the nerves here. There's a reduction in the nerve fibers. See, they're gone compared to over here. And then there's these things called neurite swellings. They're swollen. They're tortuous. And you can imagine, patients often tell us, I just feel like my nerves are firing, or I have pins and needles. It's probably these nerves just firing randomly because they're damaged. They're broken. They're not working right. They're swollen. and misfires and sends the wrong information to the brain. This might be a patient who says to you, don't put that sheet on my feet. It hurts my feet. Any pressure hurts their feet whatsoever. Oh, so Jennifer asked a really good question. If a patient is diagnosed with neuropathy and they get their blood glucose under control, can they reverse their neuropathy? Or does it get better? Okay, this is a great question. So if my blood sugars are running in the 300 and 500s, I'll just, you know, make it pretty dramatic, then I get my blood sugars down to 100, and I do that for a few months, my nerve pain will diminish. It will diminish. If I still have pain in my nerves, that's a good sign. It means my nerves are alive and firing. But if my nerves are already dead, if I don't feel anything, if they're numb, it's not very hopeful. I can't usually regain that. So if patients have pain, I'm happier. That sounds bad. But I'm like, okay, your nerves are alive. If we get your blood sugar down, we can help protect your nerves and there might be some improvement. But I do want to say something very, very important, that as they get their blood sugars down initially, the pain can intensify. The pain will intensify. I've had so many patients, as their blood sugars come from 500 to 300 to 100, they'll say, wow, my nerve pain is a little bit worse. And I'm like, that's to be expected. That's normal. That's a sign that your nerves are healing. So you have to give them language for it and say, it's a sign your nerves are healing. It's a sign of recovery. Stick with it. If we can get those blood sugars around 100 consistently, or whatever your target is, that nerve pain will continue to diminish. And of course, during that time, we want to make sure that they're well medicated for pain, because we don't want them to give up. Okay, so I think another important lesson from that is if they're running 500s, we don't want to bring them down to 100 overnight. It needs to be gradual. And that gives their time, that gives their eyes time to accommodate to the new blood sugar level, because some studies have shown if you drop that blood sugar too quickly, it can cause more inflammation and visual changes in the eye. So gradual bringing down of the blood sugar seems to work better. I hope I answered that question. Okay, so there's three types of neuropathy. There's acute sensory, there's chronic sensory, and there's autonomic. And then there's this very unusual one that I see every so often, focal and multifocal neuropathy, that we'll talk about. But I want to spend a few minutes on this slide because I've seen it a few times in my career, and it's just has impressed me so dramatically. It's called acute sensory neuropathy. And these are patients who come in to see us and their A1Cs are, 13, 15, 18, very high A1Cs usually for a long period of time. And their whole body hurts. It's called acute sensory neuropathy, severe pain. I had this gal come in, her ribs hurt. It was a cold day and she had her shoes and socks off. She was walking barefoot because her feet hurt that bad. She had lost a lot of weight, very depressed. And they just feel horrible. They're hypersensitive to light touch. This gal cannot have anything touching her body. I don't know how she got dressed because it was so uncomfortable for her. But I see it says associated with hyperglycemia or rapid improvement of glucose. So we really want to go slowly on improving the glucose. But what is the treatment for this? Improve blood sugar. And that same gal who walked in barefoot, and so underweight is, I saw her at my support group a few years ago. She is now running like 5Ks, 10Ks. Her weight is great. She's doing fantastic. So it can resolve, but once you see it, you'll never forget it. The more common type of neuropathy is called chronic sensorimotor neuropathy. These are a lot of big words. And this involves a small nerve fiber. And this is often described as a stocking glove. And so you'll see patients, it starts from their fingertips and their toe tips and works its way centrally. It starts distally and it works its way proximal. And this is C fiber nerve pain, burning and superficial. Sometimes they'll just say everything hurts. And then as it continues, they lose pressure and temperature sensation, and they have decreased blood flow and sweating. These patients with small nerve fiber disease are at very high risk for ulceration, Charcot, which is a collapsing of the foot, and gangrene. How do we detect loss of C nerve fiber? monofilament. So that little monofilament, we put it on the bottom of their foot, and we press it gently to make it bend into a C. And if they cannot feel that, it delivers 10 grams of linear pressure. If they can't feel that monofilament, they've lost some of their nerves, and they're very high risk for foot problems. These patients will often complain of the pain gets worse at night. They're sleeping and their legs are aching. And then as we keep going, we start involving large nerve fiber. And this involves sensory or motor nerves. These fibers are myelinated and they're the rapid conductors. So they have that fat sheath around them and they conduct nerve impulses. And if you start damaging those, these are patients who walk, I would say walk funny, but it's also described as moonwalking. And that is they put their foot down gingerly. They don't know where their foot is in space. And so you'll see them trying to figure out, where is my foot landing? How is it landing? And they don't really know where it's landing because they can't feel it. A lot of patients with dialysis, if you work in dialysis or see patients on dialysis units, have this ataxia or moonwalking. Lots of times they'll have a shortening of the Achilles tendon and a clawfoot. And so their Achilles tendon shortens up, and that can lead to all kinds of problems with walking. And then their toes become more like hammer toes. They really do need a good shoe to accommodate that. So the symptoms may be minimal. They may have impaired vibration or position sense, but they're very high risk for foot problems. So when patients come in, how do we treat neuropathy? I've said this a million times, but it bears being said again. Improved glycemic control. Pain management is a big deal. As diabetes educators, I am not, you know, a specialist in pain management, but I do know when somebody's having too much pain that we need to get them help. And so we need to really advocate on their behalf, because many times neuropathic pain is under-treated and ignored, and it affects all facets of people's life. And then there's depression from chronic pain. Massage can help, stretching, pain control clinic, TENS, avoiding alcohol, and relaxation. And then as part of your handouts, I did put together a sheet on neuropathy medications for diabetes. This is really hard information to find. I did a lot of searches and I finally found some good articles, and I put this together for you. And it's mostly from Dr. Ziegler from Diabetes Care 2009. He has a lot of expertise in this area. So I did mention B12 earlier. B12 does seem to help some people with neuropathic pain, especially if they're B12 deficient. That's something they could try. But also alpha-lipoic acid. This is over-the-counter. 600 to 1,800 milligrams a day really seems to help as some of our patients. And then there's prescription therapy, the tricyclic antidepressants, calcium channel modulators, the gabapentin. We see that a lot, the Neurontin. And then we have the serotonin, norepinephrine, reuptake inhibitors. So I would say the most popular ones I see out there are the tricyclics and the gabapentin. And Lyrica is also out there now as a tool to help patients live with this chronic pain and diminish it. A second line is topical capsaicin cream. Now, capsaicin cream is hot chili pepper. And you can apply that on your feet twice a day. You have to do it twice a day for a week to see if it will work. But sometimes it can block that C nerve fiber pain. The most common reasons for treatment failure include the medication dose is too low, or they don't do an adequate trial, and also patient expectations. They think that this nerve pain is going to go away, but really the nerve pain may not ever go away. We're just going to diminish it and control it. So helping them with visualization, relaxation, yoga, all of that is so, so important for treating neuropathy. So now we're going to talk about autonomic neuropathy. And I want to ask you this question. Which of the following patients are at most risk for developing diabetes autonomic neuropathy? And I'm going to launch the poll. Is it A person for 1 year? That was not very good grammar. A person has diabetes for 1 year with an A1C of 7.6, or B, a person with diabetes for 16 years with an A1C never above 6.9, Or C, a person with type 1 diabetes for 8 years with retinopathy. Or D, a person with type 2 diabetes for 19 years with an A1C less than 7.5. And while you're there, if you didn't have a chance yet to print out the autonomic neuropathy clinical features extra sheet I provided with your handout, it would be really great if you could grab that now and print it out, because I'll be referring to it. But if you don't print it out now, that's okay. You can look at it later. I stole this page on autonomic neuropathy clinical features from the Art and Science book. And I have the new version of the Art and Science book. It's 2013, and I went to see if they had updated it, and they haven't. It's still 2005. So it's a good handout, and it summarizes a lot of the autonomic neuropathies. And don't tell AADE that I stole it from them. It's just one page. I think it's going to be okay. All right. So we're back to this poll here. Who's at most risk? I'm going to close the poll and share your answers with you. And so now you can see 13% of you chose this diabetes for 1 year with an A1C of 7.6. Very low chance of autonomic neuropathy. Autonomic neuropathy really takes time to happen usually, and autonomic neuropathy is usually associated with other opathies like retinopathy or nephropathy. So if a patient has one of the opathies, I kind of assume and look for the other ones, because microvascular disease happens similarly in one person throughout their life. So let's look at B. Person with diabetes for 16 years, A1C never above 6.9. Very low risk for neuropathy. But this C, this person with type 1 diabetes for 8 years with retinopathy. So this person, even though they've only had diabetes for 8 years, type 1, they already have eye disease. This means new blood vessels growing. I know that their whole vasculature throughout their body is compromised. So if you, even though this person hasn't had diabetes as long as some of our other patients, the fact that she has retinopathy tells me that her blood sugars have not been to target, or there's other things happening, he or she, in their life. I'm not blaming anybody, but I'm just saying, if they have retinopathy, I'm going to look for autonomic neuropathy. This is really an important quiz here. So if they've, and these other situations, even though they've had diabetes for a long time, their A1C is really terrific. The one at highest risk is C, because she has retinopathy. Okay, let me hide this. Now let's wrap up. We have a few more minutes to go. I'm so glad that you're joining us today to talk about this very important topic, because so many of our patients are struggling with these complications and they need support, help, resources. Diabetic autonomic neuropathy is often referred to as DAN. 50% of patients with peripheral neuropathy, remember the nerve fiber damage that happens from the stocking glove nerve fiber damage, if they have that type of peripheral neuropathy, 50% of them also have DAN. DAN increases mortality and morbidity rates. It can lead to problems with your bladder, and this is where that handout comes in, because I really detail it out. Neurogenic bladder, sexual dysfunction, we'll talk about in a minute. GI-related disorders, especially gastroparesis, sometimes they get nocturnal diarrhea. This can really affect quality of life. Orthostatic hypotension, they, no matter what, they just stand up and their blood pressure crashes. And we'll have to do very, you know, there has to be a lot of testing to identify that, and then they require medications to keep their blood pressure up. Another problem is cardiac in nature, fixed heart rate, silent MI, and sudden death. So people with diabetes are at more risk for sudden death from heart attack, and they may not experience the symptoms of a heart attack very clearly. If you look at the handout, you'll see that they may experience it as, you know, sweating. They don't feel right, kind of confusion. But they may not get that crushing chest pain because of the neuropathy. It's blocked that relay of information to the brain. They might have hypoglycemia unawareness. They get low blood sugar and they don't feel it. And this is an interesting one. Patients with autonomic neuropathy often sweat a lot when they eat. It's called pseudomotor. When they eat, they sweat. That's a one sign. Another sign of autonomic neuropathy. And so you can take a look at the handout and see the different symptoms, the tests, and the treatments that are available for it. But I'd like to just wrap up on sexual function. And I was teaching a diabetes class the other day, and I was like, oh, man, most of my patients were in their 70s, and I was talking about sex, and they were very interested in this topic, let me tell you. And so you think, like, do you really need to bring this up? And absolutely, we do want to talk about sex because for a lot of people, it's an important part of life. So this is just kind of a funny slide I show in all my classes. Sexual function as we age, 20 to 30 years, twice daily. 30 to 40 years, try weekly in different variations. 60 to 70 years, try oysters. 70 to 80, try anything. And 80 to 90, just try and remember. And this, I also borrowed this from this book, A Touch of Humor, New Perspectives on Erectile Dysfunction. That I had one gal, she was in my class and she was 94. And she goes, I don't see my category on there. But erectile dysfunction does affect about 50% of men with diabetes, and it's an autonomic neuropathy, but it also is an indication of vascular damage. So if they have ED, I know they're at higher risk for heart attack and stroke. I know that they're at risk for having poor blood flow to their heart. So it's a nice indicator for us to kind of check their cardiovascular risk profile too. The treatment for this I've listed here, but we need to use caution if they're taking any nitrate drugs. So really, I encourage my patients, talk to your doctor first before you get on these medications. Don't order them from Canada or order them online. You want to do it safely. And many of our patients with diabetes don't respond well to these medications. So we definitely want to let them know, if one doesn't work, try another one. And sometimes they'll have more success with some of the other medications. I just want to show you some other things that we can use to help men with erectile dysfunction. And you might want to ask, where did Beverly get this handout from? And actually, I got it from Diabetes Forecast. And this is a vacuum device that you put on your penis, and you press the button, and it pulls blood into the penis, and then you use one of these rings to hold the blood in, and that ring stays at the base of the penis, and then, of course, you take it off after intercourse. And then this one patient in my class raises her hand and she goes, well, make sure you take off the ring, but make sure you also take off the vacuum device before intercourse. I don't know. I just, you know, I've heard it all pretty much. But this is funny because it's covered by Medicare and insurance. I do want to say that women with diabetes do also have sexual dysfunction. And that comes in the form of vaginal dryness, yeast infections, lack of ability to achieve orgasm. And so for both men and women, the most important thing, again, is getting blood sugar and blood pressure to target. That can really help. But additionally for men, they have a higher risk of low testosterone level. And so we want to you talk to our men about that. If they're having low sex drive, erectile dysfunction, depression, we can look for total testosterone. Usually we look in the morning to see if they're hypogonadal, if it's less than 300. And then we're going to provide treatment. There's been some controversy about testosterone replacement therapy, so we want to weigh the risk versus the benefit. But certainly for some of our men, it really does seem to be beneficial. Like this guy, he went on Androgel testosterone replacement therapy, and he's looking very happy. And my favorite thing he says here is, things are looking up. Okay, so to wrap up on neuropathy, so we talked about the polyneuropathies, we talked about autonomic neuropathies, and now we're going to talk about focal neuropathies. Now, focal neuropathies often occur in middle-aged patients or those with polyneuropathies. And the major one I see for patients with diabetes is carpal tunnel. So carpal tunnel is an entrapment of a nerve, and it's more common in diabetes, maybe with the glycosylation of tendons and the glycosylation of nerves. You know, there's just a related situation. They can also happen in their femurs. They get femoral neuropathy in the side of their leg. Radiculopathy, I've seen that. They have rib pain. And then this I've never seen, but it can happen. Abrupt onset of headache or eye pain. But to wrap up with neuropathy, the key consideration is a very long-term complication, often under-recognized and under-treated. As diabetes educators, we certainly are going to be advocates for management and treatment. The treatment is complex. We want to know about some resources that they can take advantage of. Getting that thorough history and assessment is critical, and the treatment is based on the underlying process, presentation, and cost effectiveness. And hopefully there's going to be some new therapies on the horizon that can really help our patients struggling and living with neuropathy. And to wrap up, I do show this slide in my diabetes class. Here's the ABCs of diabetes control, but I've added some other things. The D, drugs, keep a list for emergencies and for your providers. E, exercise and eyes. F, food and your feet. G, glucose goals, glucose checks and goals, and H, healthy coping, and hooray for all your hard work. Diabetes is complicated. It's a lot of work. It's a lot of doctor visits, a lot of lab tests, and it's a lot of medications. And in addition to all that, you have to eat healthy and exercise every day. So we just want to give them a lot of kudos for all the good work they are doing every day to help manage their diabetes and really impress upon them that their hard work is going to make a difference. I do want to say that this is a course on the chronic complications of diabetes. I do have a course on the acute complication, hyperglycemic crisis. It's in the level 2 courses, and that is a great review of DKA, HHS, and hyperglycemic crisis. I want to thank you so much for joining us today. It's such a pleasure to share this. Information with you. I'm sorry, I thought I was having a technical difficulty, but it really is such a great, I love sharing this information with all of you, and I want to thank you for spending an hour and a half of your time with this information, and I appreciate you sharing it with your clients and with your providers, because as a community of diabetes educators, I know we can make a big difference in improving outcomes and helping people get the care that they need. This is Beverly Tomasian. I'll be signing off, but after I press the stop recording button, I will stay on for any additional questions. Thank you so much for joining us.